From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, should we continue charging Michigan prisoners for basic necessities and services?
Imagine a $5 copay for medical is 25% of your earned wages in the month.
One study finds Pure Michigan isn't giving us much bang for the buck. Another says, yes, it does. How can one set of numbers lead to wildly different conclusions?
The true answer is not easy to find. If we did 10 studies, I'll bet they wouldn't all give exactly the same number.
What's really behind this selfie obsession?
I think that we all figure out how we want to be seen in the world, and the technology is just one part of that.
And we'll explore the history of our love of bland, wimpy beer. Those stories and more today on Stateside. In Michigan, inmates are charged for necessities. Backers argue it's a way to trim corrections costs, but critics think it's wrong.
If we are going to make meaningful cuts to corrections and to prison spending, we have to get people out of the system and close prisons. It should not fall on the backs of prisoners.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, just how much does crime and corrections really cost? But first, a 3.3 magnitude earthquake got things rumbling near Battle Creek this morning. This quake was centered 13 miles southeast of Battle Creek and felt as far south as northern Indiana and as far north as Holland. And it's just a few miles from where that 4.2 magnitude quake happened on May 2nd. Harley Benz is a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Harley, a 3.3 is considered what, small, middling?
Yeah, small. It's one that we would not expect any damage, but would be widely felt.
And we should note the Calhoun County Sheriff's Department agrees with you, Harley. They say no damage, no injuries from today's 3.3. I think what has people wondering, you have two quakes very close together and less than 2 months apart. Is that surprising for Michigan?
Yeah, it's an area that, you know, certainly doesn't have large earthquakes. And in fact, the 4.2 is one of the largest since the 1940s. And so earthquakes in Michigan are rare. These two earthquakes are about 20 miles apart from each other, so it'd be hard to describe this second one as an aftershock of the first one. But they are probably tectonic-related. They're both pretty shallow. They're likely occurring in the upper portion of the crust in the crystalline basement rocks. When we first had a reported location for this, I was just assuming it was in the same spot as the one on May 2nd, and it wasn't. I was a little bit surprised by that. We've looked at the data on the two, and yes, they are separated by about 20 kilometers.
You mentioned the 1940s, Harley Benz, and I know that there was a quake in Coldwater in 1947. Do you think the quakes from May and today's are part of that same fault?
Yeah, they're in the same area. There was an earthquake there, in 1947. It was in this Kalamazoo Battle Creek area. Back then, we have very poor instrumentation in order to locate the event. So we don't, you know, from looking at these three events, we know this area has produced earthquakes. They're just simply rare.
Now, we checked a State Department of Environmental Quality map, and it indicates there's been quite a bit of fracking in Calhoun County. Could these two quakes be at all related to fracking activity, either past or present?
We haven't looked at the details of these events, looking at the characteristics of the signal, other than being able to locate the earthquake and produce a magnitude. We haven't looked at them in detail to see if they're related to industrial activity. And in fact, you know, we would need to know where the activity is occurring and times of fracking. That information is not very easily accessible for us. So the best we can do right now is just locate and report their magnitude.
And what do you watch for going forward?
Well, it's I was just talking to others here. We will certainly keep monitoring it and pay attention to it. And if we have a few more, we'll start to look at this in more detail.
Meaning what?
Well, one of two things, we'll do some extra additional modeling to see how, if we can link these events in terms of the similarity of their waveforms. Look for much smaller earthquakes. There's modeling methods we can do to look in detail at really tiny events. The trade-off there is we don't have that many seismic stations in this part of the world, and if we do detect smaller ones, we may not be able to locate them because there's just not enough stations, seismic stations in the area.
Harley Benz is with the U.S. Geological Survey. Harley, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
As state lawmakers search for money to fix the roads and put the budget together, they have been eyeing the budget of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation and the Pure Michigan Campaign. The recently passed budget cut MEDC funding by $15 million, and with that has come debate about the effectiveness of the Pure Michigan campaign. The MEDC oversees Pure Michigan. There have been wildly differing reports on just how effective Pure Michigan is. But how can one set of numbers serve up such hugely different conclusions? So let's see if we can sort this out as we say hello to Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard. Charlie, always good to have you and your economist brain with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
So, Charlie, here's what got us puzzled. The Mackinac Center for Public Policy released a preliminary report on the effectiveness of government spending on tourism, and it states that for every dollar spent in tourism promotion programs like Pure Michigan, it generates just one penny extra spending at motels and hotels, the accommodations industry. On the other hand, the MEDC tells us every dollar spent on Pure Michigan generates $6.87 in return. That is a big gap. What's going on?
You know, in the physical sciences, the physicists can accurately measure things down to 10 decimal places.
Yes.
The mathematicians can do that. When you're dealing with economics and political issues, you're dealing with people, and people are much harder to quantify. We have to make assumptions that may or may not be fully correct. Basically, if you wanted to do the study right, you would say, what would the world have looked like without Pure Michigan, and what would it look like with Pure Michigan, holding constant everything else? But it's really difficult to hold constant everything else, and that's the art and the science of doing these kind of studies, and it's not easy. I don't want to make your listeners think that we just can't trust any studies, but it is inherently difficult. And I think it's also true, unfortunately, that if you've got an ideological bias, that might enter into your decisions about what you include in your study.
So, Charlie, what I think I hear you saying is one group will do its study, and in the heart of that study and all the details, there are things they look at. There's a set of parameters. Other group, same thing. They've got their own set of parameters, so they may not be exactly the same. You get different results, but the public hears that big one bottom line conclusion.
Exactly. Unfortunately, of course, the public doesn't have much of a way to evaluate what's in the guts of the study. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Let's say it's 1961 and President Kennedy suggests that we should fly to the moon. Well, you could do a cost-benefit analysis of that. And if you were to define the benefits in the narrowest possible way, what would you say? You would say it would cost many billions of dollars to land a man on the moon, and all we would get would be a couple of hundred pounds of rocks.
True.
Well,
you could.
You could do that. But I would assert that that wouldn't be the right way to do it. That's one way to do it. But in fact, I believe that the moonshot was a good program. And yet, some of the things that I would include in the calculation are very difficult to measure. Some of them are sort of not too hard to measure, like we had improvements in computers and telecommunications and all that that were direct spin-offs of the space program. But on the other hand, I think we had a huge boost to American national pride. And how do you put a dollar value on that? It's extremely hard. Similar to the Pure Michigan. I actually like the Pure Michigan campaign. One reason that I like it is that in Michigan, we have had a tough period economically. GM and Chrysler and the city of Detroit have all gone bankrupt. Mm-hmm. It's easy to become discouraged, and I love the Pure Michigan campaigns because they put emphasis on what a beautiful place this is, and they tell that to us here at home, and they tell it to the rest of the world. But, of course, that's an extremely difficult thing to put a dollar value on.
So when we hear these kinds of reports, how is the public supposed to figure them out and know what to accept?
Well, I wish I had an easy answer for you, Cindy, but the best we can do is to have as many studies as we can. It helps if you've got more than one. And if you've got one study that says there's $6.73 benefit for every dollar of expenditure, and if you've got another that says there's a penny of benefit for every expenditure, at least you can probably think that the answer is somewhere in between, the true answer. But I would say again, the true answer is not easy to find. If we did 10 studies, I'll bet they would be in a much narrower range, and yet they wouldn't all give exactly the same number.
Interesting. And, you know, as you say that, we often see that in public health, don't we? You'll get a study that says, don't drink coffee. And then here comes another study saying, yes, it is good for you. And the public will say, I don't know what to believe. I'm not believing any of you. I mean, you do hear that kind of conversation.
Absolutely. And there's a real danger in that, because if the public turns off and says, I can't believe anything, then, especially in the public health arena that you mentioned, that can be really dangerous, because I think the accumulation of evidence over time is probably pushing us in the right direction. But it takes time, and it takes careful reexamination of the data before we narrow down our estimate of what's going on in public health and in Pure Michigan and in so many other places.
Talking numbers and crunching data and trying to make sense of it with Michigan State Economics Professor Charlie Ballard. Always a pleasure, Charlie. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just think, just a few years ago, we had never even heard the word selfie. These days, our social media feeds are stuffed with them, and it's sparking conversations and questions. Are these ridiculous? Are they just a deep dive into narcissism, or are they important ways to curate and record our lives? Kimberly Springer is Michigan Radio's social media producer. What do you hear as people kick around that topic of selfies? Because it certainly seems to inflame people.
I always seem to come back to generation, which I apologize for, but it seems like an older generation doesn't understand it, thinks it's about vanity and narcissism, whereas a younger generation just takes it as a way of taking control of their self-representation, which is what a lot of social media is about. And I read one columnist from the New York Times, Jenna Wortham, who had a really interesting idea about selfies, is that it's a way of captioning ourselves on social media. So it's a way of creating punctuation. And I think that we're also learning how to communicate differently with social media. So I think that's all part of that process of exploration.
Okay, so let's talk about the kind of selfie that we see very commonly posted by teenage girls. We've all seen them. They're probably wearing a skimpy tank top or a camisole, and they're posing in the bathroom mirror. Duck lips are almost always
trout
mandatory.
Pout.
Trout pout. And if you take that up or down, we might say, if few degrees, you get Miley Cyrus and the Kardashians. And I think most parents cringe. Is that fair?
I think that we all figure out how we want to be seen in the world. And the technology is just one part of that. So I remember as a kid, my parents gave me a tape recorder. I taped myself a lot. I taped my friends. We were singing. We were just playing around and figuring out how we wanted to be in the world. So I don't think it's a cause for concern necessarily, but I think there are questions about, say, gender with girls and how they represent themselves, and if they're taking pictures to document weight loss or if it's part of some sort of eating disorder movement, then I think it can become troubling for people.
Well, as you know, we're talking about teenage girls, but the boys are into it too. And I, you know, we talk about Kim Kardashian, but there was also Justin Bieber, who was kind of the king of the look, hey, check me out selfie. But what are the boys saying? Is it different from the girls, do you think?
I think the boys are interesting in that they will pose with objects. I mean, maybe their muscles are the object, but also they'll pose with cars. They'll pose with motorcycles, not necessarily their own. So it's still about how boys are relating externally to other objects and other people. And it seems like girls are much more concerned with trying to figure out sort of who am I internally. And that's not a value judgment between boys and girls, but just a different way of how we're taught to relate to the world in terms of gender.
And there is something deep inside all of us that is very curious to see. How do I look to you? We can't get out of our – it's the only way to get out of our own skin maybe and see ourselves as others do.
And it's age old. Narcissus looking in the pool. Mm-hmm. I mean, this isn't something that's necessarily new, wanting to look at ourselves and see what we look like to the world.
Is there a difference in the way that a selfie is received depending upon where you post? For example, is the reception perhaps different on Instagram than it might be on Facebook?
I think you're tapping into something there with the difference of the medium. So Instagram is very much about photography, and I've heard that the young people use it for dating as well. So of course you're going to have selfies there versus someplace like Facebook or Snapchat, which is also quite visual.
Now, I have to ask about the selfie stick. We got talking today in the office, and one of our coworkers said she was at a graduation last weekend and saw at least 15 selfie sticks. And she said, but there were people everywhere. So here's the question. Why not be social and say, hey, Kimberly, can you take a picture of me with my friends, as opposed to waving a stick around? What do you think's going on with that selfie stick?
Well, I'm no art historian, but it seems like there is a different way of framing yourself when you take the photo yourself. And you're being social with the people you're with as opposed to with someone off camera, which I think is a different kind of relationship. And, you know, when you're taking a picture, you have a different reaction to the person taking it if it's someone you know versus someone who's a stranger. There might be a different kind of warmth in your eyes and congeniality that happens that way.
As opposed to my polite smile because I don't know you and I don't want you to think I'm a jerk. You know, I think about a perspective of a few years. It was not awfully long ago that the Polaroid was the latest, coolest thing, and now it's in a museum. So do you see the selfie going the way of the Polaroid, or what do you think will be the next big thing?
Well, the selfie's actually the end product, right? I mean, the Polaroid camera itself and the mobile phone, those are two different kinds of technology. So who knows what's going to come down the pike in terms of the technology that allows us to represent ourselves. It could be like hologram glasses or something.
And I do remember getting a camera for Christmas back in the, I want to say it was the 70s or the late 60s, and I forget the name of it, but the whole point was extreme close-up. Mm-hmm. And you looked horrible. You know, today we have all the great filters and all the things you can do. But I remember that died a pretty quick death, that particular camera. And other people listening of a certain baby boomer generation may remember that camera. And you looked and went, whoa, no thanks. So when you play with your image, that's all part of it. There's so many apps now to, you know, kind of give you that whatever you artsy thing you want to do with your image.
Right. I mean, it could be a funhouse image. Take, for example, the rapper Nicki Minaj. Part of her sort of image is based on a very pretty girl looking grotesque in some way. So we can play with those different kinds of images with the different lens types and different filters that these apps allow us to experiment with.
All right. And now we're going to have to take a selfie. Kimberly Springer is Michigan Radio's social media producer. Thanks so much, Kimberly.
Thank you.
Hey, America. The rest of the world has a question. What is up with the bland beer? It's no secret that the American beer market is dominated by pale, mild beer, bland beer. Despite the rising number of craft brewers here in Michigan and across the country, our best-selling beer is Bud Light. And Coors Light and Miller Lite are coming in right behind it. Economist Runjit Dighey wanted to figure out why it is Americans like bland beer. Runjit is professor and chair of the economics department at the State University of New York at Oswego. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
Your article for Business History points out that you're not making judgment calls on bland beer, right? As you say, one person's insipid is another's refreshing.
Yeah, I used to make judgment calls like that all the time, but that's when I was 20.
So your study finds that our taste for pale bland beer, it goes way back in American history?
Oh, yes, way back, 19th century.
What was the early American beer brewing scene like?
The very early American scene was more like ale. It was very much in the English tradition, not radically dissimilar from a lot of the ales that one might get over in England right now. But it was a very small part of the overall alcoholic beverage market. In colonial days, rum was the big beverage. In early America, it was whiskey. And cider was actually more common and a lot easier to make than beer. This is up through about the 1830s. Then you have the temperance movement, which kind of shuts down everything. It was the early temperance movement. This wasn't prohibition. This was voluntary temperance pledges. And that drastically cut the demand for whiskey. Whiskey consumption drops dramatically, and cider consumption just about goes off the table. What happens right after that, though, is you get a big influx of German immigrants. They bring their lager beer with them, and that becomes very popular among Americans. This was a more intense kind of lager. It was a lot darker, kind of like what, if you're buying German beer, would be a Dunkel right now. Maybe not that different from, say, a Heineken Dark or a Beck's Dark that you could buy today. That's obviously a lot different from, say, Bud Light. That was popular. It was lighter than some of the ales that might have been available at the time. It was more just something that you could consume kind of at your leisure, or that had actually more than just a leisure drink, but something that you could consume, you know, at lunch, and then go back to work, or have, you know, a few of in a saloon and then go back home. So that was popular. And people didn't know exactly how intoxicating that was. We didn't have, you know, ABV information printed on labels or anything like that. But people found that it wasn't getting them all that drunk, and they were happy with that. It kind of fit the needs. This was a country where you had, you know, industrialization going on and really long work hours. You know, a 70-hour week was not at all uncommon. People would go to lunch wherever they could near the factory. Often that was a saloon. If they came back drunk, they were fired. So even without a temperance movement, you would have pressure to find some kind of drink that isn't going to get you drunk when you need to go back to work right away.
So keeping that alcohol content down. Then what, take us up to Prohibition, because that surely changed, shook things up.
Yeah, Prohibition really impacted beer a lot more than it impacted wine and spirits. One of the great myths of Prohibition is that it didn't do anything, that people just went on drinking just like they had before. That's really not true. What is true is that it was probably good for spirits consumption. Spirits like whiskey, vodka, or whatever are pretty easy to conceal. You know, people have little flasks during Prohibition that they carried with them. A flask full of beer isn't really going to do you much good. So beer was the main casualty of Prohibition. A lot of smaller breweries, all of the breweries shut down legally. And finding a full-scale brewery that made real professional quality beer was not easy during Prohibition. In areas where there was a big mob presence, like Chicago or Newark, you could get good beer, or good by the standards of pre-Prohibition. Otherwise, you're kind of on your own as far as beer went, and you probably found it a lot easier to purchase, you know, spirits that were available somewhere that were traded on a black market or perhaps wine.
Sure. Now, what about going through from between the Depression and the 30s and then with all the rationing and the home hardships during World War II, did that make an effect?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you have an economy of privation during the 1930s and during World War II. World War II, everybody had a job, sure, but people didn't have a lot that they could spend their money on. There was lots of rationing and just kind of a pressure, you know, against conspicuous consumption. A lot of the breweries were still in business. And in fact, they were producing, you know, as part of the rations that our soldiers got in World War II, 3.2% beer. So our soldiers were getting weak beer. Weak beer was basically was available back home. And people had shown a taste for weak beer. In the very first year that beer was legal during the Depression, which was 1933, this was for about 8 months or so, prior to the repeal of Prohibition itself, beer was just, or rather the Volstead Act, which enforced Prohibition. This was passed, you know, around 1919, 1920. That was modified in 1933 to change the definition of what was intoxicating from 0.5% under Volstead, which basically excluded everything, to 3.2%. And so 3.2% meant that weak beer was legal. Mm. And when they put it back on the market, the public had an enormous appetite for it.
Not too hoppy.
Yeah, very mild beer. Right, and not very hoppy. That was sort of a separate issue. You know, like right now there's session IPAs and so forth that can be quite mild as far as the alcohol content. I just had one the other day that was, I think, 3.8% alcohol, and it was very good. But, yeah, the brewers found that the public just didn't have much appetite for hoppy beers. And this was even relative to before Prohibition, when they had become, you know, pretty mild already and not very hoppy. I think some of that was just that they weren't used to beer. They'd gone almost 15 years without access to real, you know, professional quality beer.
Good point. And then looking at, it's say, the past half century or so, I mean, we baby boomers grew up with Miller Lights, tastes great, less filling. And that really wasn't so much about weight. Eh? It was about being able to let people, you know, drink more of it and don't get filled up.
Right. It's good for social drinking. If you're drinking beer socially, you know, it can go down kind of fast. You want to be able to have a lot of those. Like Schaefer had the campaign, the beer to have when you're drinking more than one.
Hmm.
And, yeah, less filling is kind of the same thing, that it won't slow you down. That was a slogan that Coors Light actually had. I think the FCC or the regulators told them they had to stop that because it seemed to be encouraging, you know, binge drinking or something like that.
So it strikes me that Americans, you know, we want to be able to drink beer after beer after beer at a tailgate, whereas if I'm at a beer hall in Munich, it's a different purpose. So I'm going to be able to access a much heartier, if you will, hoppier beer?
That could very well be. Also, in Europe, things are a lot more densely populated. If you're going out to the beer hall, you might not be driving home. You might be walking home or taking public transportation. In America, from a bar, you're probably driving home. With the rise of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and, you know, stiffer penalties for drunk drivers, people have to be very conscious of that. They're often going to go for what seems lighter.
I noticed as I looked at the chart in your article for Business History, lots of mentions of there's light beers and then lots of mentions of pilsners and lagers. And I'm thinking of when I was in Bavaria, in the lagers and pilsners there, are they not as bland as an American version?
Yeah, they are different. One key difference is the use of adjuncts, that is things other than just malt and hops and barley. Germany has that famous, you know, Reinheitsgebot. I think I butchered the pronunciation of that, Reinheitsgebot. Law, the Bavarian purity law, that says you can just have these four ingredients. I think it's malt, barley, hops, and water in beer. And that's kind of how it was in the mid-19th century here. Some of the brewers like Anheuser-Busch and Pabst and Miller found that people actually liked the beer better if you diluted it somewhat with things like corn and rice. That made for a weaker beer, if not in alcohol content, then certainly as far as the flavor or heartiness of it. And that's kind of what changed it. It was partly the taste that people had. There could be a number of factors. One, again, as I mentioned, that it tastes like it would somehow be less intoxicating if it's blander and if it's lighter in color. And a lot of people had to go back to work, you know, working these really long days in a tough labor market where there's plenty of people outside the factory gates. You'd be very happy to take your job if you're fired for drunkenness or what have you. It's also a little bit warmer in the States, especially, you know, toward the south than it was in Europe. So that'd be another factor why you might want something a bit paler and more refreshing.
I'm wondering, Rajat, what impact do you see the American craft beer movement having on palates? It does take a while to train palates and to get people to catch on to new flavors, but what do you see happening?
Seems to be kind of a generational thing. I see a lot of young people who are drinking craft beers. Craft beers were kind of a yuppie phenomenon at one point, and you still kind of see that among older people. Someone age 50, you know, who's blue collar is probably more likely to be drinking Bud or Bud Light, whereas someone who's age 50 and, you know, higher income and so forth is more likely to be drinking craft beer. But at about age 20, I don't really notice that much of a difference.
Do you see a growing future for these darker or hoppy beers here?
Absolutely. They're the fastest growing segment of the market by far. On the other hand, you know, Bud Light, Coors Light, Miller Light, those are the biggest ones. And there's always going to be some kind of demand for that because those beers are sessionable. You know, you can have a nice long drinking session. You know, you can watch all three football games on Sunday while drinking continuously. I'm not saying anybody should do that, but there's lots of people who do. And something like Bud Light is much better suited to that than a double IPA is.
Very interesting look at the American taste in bland beer. Ranjit Dighe is a professor and chair of the economics department at the State University of New York at Oswego. Very interesting to get your economist take on this. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As veterans return home after serving in the Middle East, this nation's becoming more and more aware of PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury. It affects millions of veterans, and it boosts the risk of depression, suicide, and drug and alcohol-related deaths. And for veterans struggling with PTS, it can lead to more run-ins with police. And that's why the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency teamed up with the Michigan State Police, county and local law enforcement, and the School of Criminal Justice at Michigan State University. The result is a video that guides police on how to interact with veterans struggling with PTS, as well as some special business cards. Jeff Barnes is director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello, Cindy. Thank you for having us.
Yes, and we're also joined by Michigan State Police Trooper Todd Wade. Hello, Todd.
Hello.
Good to have you here. Todd, take us day to day in your work with the MSP. Are you and other troopers noticing more encounters with veterans as you patrol and make stops?
Yes, we are. Obviously, the number of veterans is growing every day, and more are coming home, getting released from active duty, or just getting home from the actual theater of war. 99% of those encounters go most of the time. You wouldn't even know that there was a veteran involved.
But that 1%?
That 1%, sometimes veterans having problems and they need help. What we've done here is we've been able to provide a video that police officers can watch and prepare them for that encounter.
Jeff, what are you seeing on the statewide level? What ways can an interaction between police and a vet, especially one with PTSI, how can they go wrong?
Well, what I've seen is we've got about 50 to 70,000 post-9/11 veterans that call Michigan home. And we expect that number to double in the next 5 years. And there's really a fine line between what could be a successful intervention with a returning vet with PTS and an unsuccessful one. And what we wanted to do with the video was expose responders to the symptoms of PTS so that they could recognize it, but also let them know that there are resources available they can direct a veteran to. And that really becomes the difference between success and failure for that individual, is connecting them to some of the resources that are available for the veteran and their family so that they can make that transition home.
Not to put too fine a point on it, Jeff and Todd, both of your thoughts, I can imagine this could ultimately be a matter of life or death at times.
Absolutely.
How is the video being distributed?
So we are working closely with law enforcement. It'll be distributed on our website, which is michiganveterans.com. But we're also partnering with Michigan Sheriff's Association, the Michigan Department of Corrections, and the Michigan State Police to distribute it through their chain of command so that every officer in the state will have access to the video. It'll be distributed during roll call training. And then they'll also have resource cards that they'll be able to carry on their person so that as they encounter a veteran on the street, they'll be able to pass along that contact information to that support network that's so critical.
Todd, through this video and through this effort, what have you learned? What are the do's and don'ts that an officer should keep in mind if he or she suspects someone is suffering from PTS?
It's all about the approach and slowing the situation down. A lot of our job is reaction-based, and it's very rapidly evolving. And veterans are obviously trained to react as well. And when you get two opposing sides reacting so quickly to each other, it can quickly spin out of control. And it's all about just recognizing the situation and slowing it down as fast as you can and taking any danger out. It's not necessarily dangerous for anybody, but it can be if it gets out of control quickly.
Yeah, that's well put, that you've got two people facing each other, both of whom are trained to react in a very, very quick way. I have to imagine that part of your work, Jeff Barnes, as director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, is kind of sorting out and taking care of the main misconceptions that police and the public might have about vets who have PTS.
Yes, that is a big challenge. You know, we refer to it as PTS by choice because there is a larger discussion going on. In the VA, it's diagnosed as PTSD. Which is post-traumatic stress disorder. And we think it's very important that veterans, their family, employers, law enforcement, all of the stakeholders understand that not every veteran comes home with PTS or PTS-like symptoms. And in terms of it being a disorder versus an injury is a very distinct designation that we want to make. Because veterans come home and can receive some treatment and understand the circumstances that may make them uncomfortable, that might raise irritability, and they look to avoid those circumstances. And the vets that are able to do that and get that support network that they need are able to have a great quality of life, many to carry on in a professional career, even some in law enforcement today.
Todd, what about these business cards that have been developed for officers like you to be able to hand out to veterans? What's on them?
I haven't seen them yet, but I do believe it's going to be the number to 1-800-MICH-VET, which is a direct connection to many resources throughout the state and the country to give veterans the help they need. And that's one of the main issues, being also a veteran. There's lots of stuff out there that even I don't know about that has been compiled just with that one phone number. It's anywhere from emergency help to long-term help to just finding out what kind of benefits they have.
Tell us about your service, Todd.
I served 9 years in the Air Force as a military police and did one tour in Iraq and one tour in Kuwait.
Yeah, so you certainly do have a sense of what those vets that you're facing might be going through in their own minds. And I have to ask you about this as we come up to the 4th of July. I have noticed a big, big jump on Facebook of photos of combat veterans with lawn signs that read, "A combat veteran lives here. Please be courteous with fireworks." And I've got to imagine most people aren't thinking as they're lighting up their holiday fireworks that That noise can sound very, very different to a combat veteran. And it's easy for a vet to stay away from those big displays. But I'm kind of wondering, Jeff Barnes, what's the solution and what's the compromise within neighborhoods?
Within neighborhoods, I think it's important that community members know who their veterans are and invite them over to the 4th of July or just simply say thank you for your service and let them know that you're going to be setting off some fireworks at your house and that the veteran is either made aware that that's a possibility or invited to attend. Because what we've done with the state level is try to make some of the state parks available without fireworks this year. And those are listed on our website, which is MichiganVeterans.com. But we would really encourage citizens not to overlook that. Sometimes fireworks creates a sense of irritability or it causes a flashback into a combat engagement. And so if you have a veteran neighbor, you might want to extend that courtesy to them so that maybe they could either come and enjoy the picnic with you or they can leave the premises for a little while you and your family celebrate with fireworks.
Meaning, I guess the message is if the veteran knows the sound is coming, that's better than just this thing going off at night with no warning.
Absolutely. I look back to my first return after being in Iraq, and it was a fireworks display in Savannah, Georgia. And I remember the sound of the percussion hitting off of the buildings, and it reminded me of our movement into Baghdad in 2003. So it's something that affects everyone much differently. But it's a courtesy that you can really deconflict neighbor to neighbor and have a successful outcome.
Todd, as a state trooper, I have to ask you, with the video, the business cards for the vets, what could we all learn from this cooperative effort that can extend into the ways police interact with everyone in society?
Everybody is different, and veterans are no different from anybody else, even if they have PTSI or not. It's just the way they're going to react to certain things. And since this is a new situation, it's just everybody learning how to react to it. It's not a very big deal. It's just, hey, this person's going to react a little differently to how you work. Just be aware of it.
And we want to remind everyone again, you can find out more information about this and all the veteran supports at 1-800-MISH-VET or MichiganVeterans.com. We've been talking with Jeff Barnes, who's the director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, and with Michigan State Police Trooper and veteran Todd Waite. Thank you so much for sharing your insights, especially as we go into this 4th of July weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much does crime really cost us? Millions of dollars a day, billions per year. The high cost has jail and prison administrators seeking ways to ease the burden on taxpayers. One way to do that is charging inmates fees. In Michigan, inmates are required to pay for necessities. Backers say this teaches the prisoners a lesson and keeps them from making frivolous, wasteful requests. But what happens when that prisoner's small paycheck doesn't cover the expenses? A prisoner can wind up being paroled with hundreds of dollars of fines hanging over his or her head and wind up right back behind bars for not being able to pay up. Natalie Holbrooks with the American Friends Service Committee's Michigan Criminal Justice Program. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Doing a little bit of digging, we discovered the first correctional fee law in this country actually happened in 1846 in Michigan. So it began, and it's not a new trend, is it?
No, it's not a new trend. People have been being charged for things in prisons and jails for years and years.
So where do we stand today? How does this work in Michigan's prisons in 2015?
So in Michigan's prisons, people are responsible for paying for things like copays for medical care, over-the-counter drugs, anything bought from commissary, clothes above and beyond what the policy allows them to have. In the past, they had more clothing and more undergarments. Those, when we've been trying to make cuts to the budget, our $2.2 billion corrections budget, they sometimes are falling on the backs of prisoners, these cuts. So they get less clothing now if they want above and beyond the, I think it's 5 pairs of underwear that they get per year. They have to pay for that out of pocket. Toilet paper, if they get one roll a week at a certain prison, then they're going to pay for that. If women use more than, I think it's 24 pads per month, they have to pay for their extra menstrual pads. So they have to pay for things like that. Then there's also a reimbursement act that affects prisoners who have assets above $50,000 when they are incarcerated. So if their prisoner account is at over $1,500 or gets $1,500, it's going to be a red flag. And then the attorney general will go after any assets over $50,000. They also have restitution fines that they might have to pay. Those are court fees and restitution to crime victims. And so those will be taken from their accounts. So it will be anything over $50. The Department of Corrections is going to take 50% of anything over $50 that's in their account, which means that the family members are at times putting money into accounts and would be paying for it.
And the accounts, they work behind prison walls. What do they make for that?
About 17 cents a day. People do not make more than $20 a month for the most part in prison. So imagine a $5 copay for medical is 25% of your earned wages in the month. I don't think we think about this in the community very much, that prisoners are not paid very much money. And they don't have much when they come to prison often. I'm saying this generally. And so when they get into prison, they're not making much money. They don't go home with much money. There's no nest egg. And if we are going to make meaningful cuts to corrections and to prison spending, we have to get people out of the system and close prisons. It should not fall on the backs of prisoners. It's not a good policy move. It's not the way to go about cutting spending.
I'm talking with Natalie Holbrook. She's with the American Friends Service Committee's Michigan Criminal Justice Program. As we talk about the fact that inmates are being charged fees, we're talking about the state prison level, but we should also, which is what your area is, but we should also point out that there are fees being charged at county jails all over, not just Michigan, but all over the country, aren't there?
Yes. County jails have pay-to-stay programs where prisoners are basically charged for their meals, for the housing fee. They're charged for medical care. So that happens at the county jail level. Every county is different. In Michigan, every county is run differently. They're charged for phone calls. That happens in the state prison system also. So jails and prisons both have different ways of going about charging inmates. But the jail system has full-on pay-to-stay at some places. So I think Macomb County Jail is $56 a day per average inmate. In the state system, it's about $37,000 per year for a prisoner to stay, and taxpayers are footing that bill. The way to reduce that $2.2 billion budget is actually to send less people to prison and get people out of the system through parole reforms. So right now we have 1,500 people approximately who are past their earliest release dates who could be released to the community, I think, safely because their high probability of parole on their parole guideline score sheets, not all of them, but most of them. And we're keeping them past their earliest release date, so they could come back. So that's $37,000 here, $37,000 there, and that adds up. If we release people en masse, we could close prisons. You're not going to save money by just releasing 10 people here and 10 people there. We have to actually close prisons. And so any kinds of cuts, any kinds of cost savings that falls on the backs of inmates and prisoners, it doesn't make sense in the long term for big savings.
And we're going to get to some back and forth about that in a moment. But I want to get first the sense of how does all of this affect prisoners and, in turn, their families?
Prisoners come from marginalized communities often. They don't always have a lot of money. Their family members don't have a lot of money. And so they, I don't think, ever come back to the community set to go. Like, here's a nest egg. I have $1,000 even that I can go
get launched.
And, yes.
Yeah.
So we encourage people to save money, even though it's almost impossible to save money in prison. But we encourage people to think about, do I really need those ramen noodles from commissary? Should I save my money for this month? And so I have a nest egg of even $500 to go back home with. But when I start saying that to you, $500 or $1,000, that's nothing when you get back to the community. So I think that we have to work on pushing an ethic of work for folks that's actually compensated justly. And that would look like maybe $5 a day even in pay.
But then suddenly up go prison costs.
That's correct. But
so you know that isn't going to fly.
If we're reducing the number of people inside, and there hasn't been a wage increase since the 90s, I believe that's when it was, then what in the world are we, you know, thinking about work ethic, about keeping people out?
Long-range planning.
Yes, long-range planning, all of it. We're very much, I think, setting up a cyclical system.
Well, Natalie, you know there are people listening and people out in throughout the state saying, look, these prisoners chose to commit the crime. Why should they get a free ride on the taxpayers' collective dime? If they break the law, they should be the ones to pay for it. How do you respond to that?
I think that isolation is the way that they're paying for the crime. They're separated from society. They're separated from their families.
But they chose to commit the crime.
Correct. And they're getting their punishment, and the punishment is being disconnected from everybody. It's bare bones in there. Television may show it that they can watch movies and there's weight pits and there's all this stuff to do and it's a free ride. It's not all that. It's a struggle daily. people tell me that their worst day outside is better than their best day inside. So it is in and of itself a punishment, and I don't think that people should be expected to pay for that punishment. Of course, people will argue with me. Mm-hmm. I also think that people have to understand that folks who don't have anything aren't going to be able to pay. So we have folks who are very much in poverty in this country. They're the people targeted by the criminal justice system in a lot of ways, and they end up in prison or in jail. And to pay for it, because we criminalize everything and have long lengths of stay, it is troubling. I realize people do harmful things in community. I realize there's violence in communities. Our crime rates are not up. They've stabilized. There are alternatives to sending people to jail and prison. We should look at those alternatives. And then we wouldn't have to have this conversation at all.
And do you feel there's any political will in this state to do that?
I think our governor is leaning on towards a criminal justice reform agenda that is hopeful for the first time in years. I think that there's presumptive parole bills on the table that would get people out at their earliest release date if they're high probability of parole. I think that there's a good thing with the Criminal Justice Policy Commission, and those folks are looking at the sentencing guidelines, and hopefully we will look at those minimum sentences and send people not to prison, divert them from prison, not get probation violators into prison as much as they end up in prison. And so there are some measures out there, and the governor's behind it, it seems. So I'm hopeful, and I'm never hopeful. I'm hopeful. I'm a little bit hopeful that we're moving in a better direction than we have.
Natalie Holbrooks with the American Friends Service Committee's Michigan Criminal Justice Program. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Natalie.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.